Look at that, David. I confused myself. Alrighty, ladies, or lady and gentlemen.
Oh, you gotta throw Chad under the bus?
Unbelievable.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
All right. So I did not finish your exams like I anticipated. I apologize. I got called out of the house, and then I could not get back to the house until much later than anticipated. So we'll blame the fact that, well, I'm going to give you all a little bit of advice. When you're done with college, right, get a job. Okay? Get a job. Don't have multiple jobs. So I have 5 jobs. And the problem is that I have intent to take care of one job and other jobs get in the way. So keep your life simple, get a good paying job, focus on that. So what does that mean? Well, by next week, the grades will be available. If not sooner. Because guess what? I'll probably end up doing on Sunday night. Not like there's anything else to do on Sunday night, right? Yeah, what? Yeah, I'm sure as I'm sitting there eating the pizza and the wings and the beer, oh yeah, let's grade exams. Yeah, that sounds perfectly fine. All right. So, we got to keep going forward with our understanding of what took place in Ming China. So, we dealt with the fact that there's this concept in China called the dynastic circle. Chinese themselves believe that the dynasties rise and fall on the same pattern, which kind of makes sense, right? If you think of any other country that has had some type of government that imploded, many of the factors that the Chinese scholars point out, you can see, you know, governments don't implode. There aren't revolutions when times are good. But of course, the interesting thing about the Chinese history was it was just the rulers that were overthrown and replaced. But the system largely stayed intact. Partially because of the wholehearted beliefs that can be found in Confucianism. Chinese people embraced Confucianism. That was their morality, if you will. And one of the things, the most important things about Confucianism is, of course, the relationships. Know your role, do your role. And if everyone does their role, you can achieve balance and harmony in society. Well, we were talking about the establishment of the Ming Dynasty. And, of course, the founder of the dynasty was Hong Wu. And he was typical of all founders of dynasties. He was a war leader, he was a conqueror, and he was a reformer. And many of his reforms were similar to what other new emperors did. Bring peace, fix infrastructure, tries to boost the economy. And that's really where we left off. He centralized his power. He was in charge. He did micromanage the empire. Got rid of the chancellor. Forced all government officials to be dedicated to their jobs. Tried to prevent the types of things that destroyed other dynasties. Imposed that harsh legal system. And he also tried doing good for the folks. Infrastructure, public works programs. Protecting them from the outside invaders. Trying to get more people to own land. Encourage people to go into trades and sell goods. And of course, reduce demands of labor. All aimed at helping the majority of the people. But unfortunately, and this is where we're going to pick up, the gains for the peasants were short-lived. The problem that even an emperor as powerful as Hong Wu could not deal with was the social structure. You know, you can have a new government in charge, you can have new laws passed, but you can't change society. And one of the biggest realities of Chinese society throughout much of its history was the power of the rich. Wealth in ancient China was determined by land ownership, just like in Europe. But unlike in Europe, land ownership was not necessarily linked to nobility. You had powerful rural families that owned much of the countryside. And they made money by renting the lands to the peasants. Because they had so much wealth, many of their children were the ones that went into the imperial academies. You know, there was no requirement that you have money. But let's be honest, if you have a poor family, chances are, what are they going to need that young boy for? Yeah, they're going to need him to help out the family. They're going to need him to work. They're not going to be able to send him to school. Whereas the wealthy families, they could. So through that connection, their sons would come back and be the local governors. And of course, do things like tax breaks and give certain extra privileges to family members. You know, corruption. One of the most interesting privileges that were passed on a local level can be seen in this ancient picture, which dates back to the Ming period. Under Chinese law, local law, only landowners could ride on the back of horses and have umbrellas. So that way the sun didn't touch them. If you were a commoner, a peasant, and you had an umbrella, you could be fined. You could be arrested. You could be tortured. But again, it's one of the perks of class. Now, one of the biggest advantages that the landlords had was they were the ones who had the money. There were no banks. So, if there was a peasant, and the peasant wanted to expand his business, he had to go to his landlord and get loans. Yes?
Is this even during Tang Wu's?
Yes. Right. This is one of the points that you can't change society. Have any of you ever heard of the expression usury laws? Usury laws? Usury laws are the laws that involve banking. So in our modern society, there are laws that Massachusetts has on the books that dictate who can own a bank, interest rates they can charge, requirements, you know, capital that they have to have. All of that's done through law. Well, back then, there was no such laws. So if you were a landlord and one of your tenants came to you and asked for a loan so he could go out and buy more seed or more tools or more, I don't know, more animals, work animals, yeah, the landlord would probably give him a loan. But they would charge outrageous interest rates. One of the worst examples that I saw was there was a record of a landlord who charged one of his tenants a 370% interest rate per year. 370%! So you borrow $100, if you don't pay it off in that first year, it suddenly becomes $500. And then multiply that by almost four, suddenly it becomes $2,000. You know, the interest rates were so high, the borrower could never pay off the debt. But there was no laws that said they couldn't do it. So as a result, the landlords could keep the tenants, the peasants, poor. could keep them trapped in their social position. And this was the game that they had to play. They didn't have money to buy land, or even if they had a small plot, they probably couldn't afford to maintain it, forcing them to sell the land to the landlords, and the rich would get richer. Another common practice, you're a farming family, you can't afford the farm, you sell your farm, but you don't know other livelihood, so you end up working on the land that you once owned as a tenant. You have to pay the landlord rent. Tenant farming. So as a result, the majority of the people were trapped. So you can change all of the laws, you can try doing all the things you want, but if society is trapped because of circumstance, there's no chance of self-improvement. And to be honest with you, there was little interest in change. Chinese society, because of Confucianism, was very conservative. Very conservative. So a peasant would never challenge his place in society, because that was his lot in life. So he would just accept it. In our society, we're driven by the fake images that we see on our TikTok videos, or rap videos, or on TV, or in movies. You know, that you're going to go to college and you're going to get a job making six figures, and you're going to be able to get multiple homes and big screen TVs and travel the world. So people are sold a false bill. They have false expectations. So what happens? People get jealous. People get envious. People get greedy. In China, there's very little evidence of that existing. It wasn't even a thought. If you were born poor, that was your place. That's what you did. You just worked. So there was no push for progress. There was no push for change. There was just acceptance. Why? Well, because in their cultural values was something known as filial piety. Does anyone know what this phrase means, filial piety? Piety is proper belief, proper ethics. Filial is submission. Long story short, the Chinese had absolute respect for their superiors. Absolute respect. So, kids never questioned their parents. Young never questioned their elders. Subjects never questioned the emperor. People who are your superiors were almost worshipped because of the belief, well, that's their lot in life. That's where heaven put them. So they must be better than you. So you just accept it. Now, that's not to say that maybe deep down in someone's brain, they were having thoughts of, wow, that's just not fair. But you didn't say it. Because societal rules were enforced. They were enforced by your family. They were enforced by your village. They were enforced by the government. And they were enforced harshly. If I say the word draconian punishments, do you know what I mean by that? If something is draconian?
like harsh, like extreme?
Wicked harsh and extreme. There was an ancient jurist in Athens, a man by the name of Drakon. And he came to power at a time when, like, revolution was breaking out in Athens. So he passed a law code that essentially reestablished law and order in months. He clearly defined all of the crimes and all of the punishments. And the punishment for almost every single crime was death. Because Drakon did not believe in degree. So, in our society, you can go to somewhere like California and you can steal anything you want that's under $1,000. And you will not be arrested and go to jail. You may get a ticket. It's like a civil infraction. So there's that degree, there's that level of things that you can get away with. So people will go and they'll push the envelope, they'll go that far, and they usually don't go any farther because they know they can get away with it. Well, in Drakon's mind, a theft is a theft. If you were to steal a single piece of gummy fish or a single pencil or even a single toothpick, if you were to steal anything, that is the equivalent of stealing $1 million. Because the value of what the theft is not important. It's the crime. So if you stole anything in ancient Athens, they would tie you up, put you in a big bag, and they'd throw you in the river. And they'd hold you down with sticks until you drowned. If you stole a grape, a date, an apple, didn't matter. That was your punishment. Guess what happened to crime in Athens? Well, crimes under the Jago were punished similarly, but there also were punishments that families were able to do over their family members. And there was nothing the person who violated the rules could do. They were obligated to suffer the consequences. So, for example, socially speaking, teachers were supposed to be venerated, almost worshipped by their students, because their teachers had knowledge. And the job of a teacher is to share that knowledge. Well, in ancient China, if a student questioned their teacher, just questioned, they could be beheaded and they'd suffer the same fate as someone who cheated on the exam. Your head would be mounted on a pike inside the wall so all of the other students could see. Your body would be thrown over the wall and your family could come and collect it. After it rotted, you couldn't take the fresh corpse. Had to leave the body out there at least for a week or two. So that way it would get ripe. Why? Well, a student doesn't know better than the teacher. So what is the student questioning the teacher about? Or challenging the teacher? Women. Women were similarly had their lives regulated. Now, the degree ultimately depended upon the family. So I can't make a general statement that all girls were abused by modern standards, because that's factually not true. Ultimately, a girl's life was completely dependent upon who her father was. But, they had to settle for it. The girls had to accept their fate. Because culturally, girls were expected, all girls were expected to follow the three obediences, and they had to embrace the four virtues. All women in China were expected to adhere to the three obediences, the three people who you are to obey. When you were born, all girls were expected to obey their fathers. Absolutely. Then, once the father arranged a marriage, the girl would be expected to absolutely obey her husband. That's obedience number two. And then once her husband died, because chances are the husband's probably 10 to 15 years older than the girl, the woman was expected to absolutely obey her son, who essentially would take control over the household. So the three obediences: father, husband, son. And these men literally had the power of life and death over the girls. As far as the four virtues, well, Chinese culture dictated that all girls display these virtues at all times. That they display fidelity. What's fidelity?
Is that like loyalty?
Yeah, loyalty, yeah. So a woman is never going to think about, say, cheating on her husband. She's going to be loyal to her husband. She's going to be loyal to daddy. She's going to be loyal to her son. Fidelity. Virtue number two. They have to have physical charm. They have to have physical charm. They have to make themselves pretty, desirable. Because a man is not going to want a woman who's not attractive. Because, by the way, that's the only way a girl could get. There was no love, there was no romance. If a potential husband didn't find the young woman attractive, he'd just say no. And then the dad would freak out. Oh my God, I got her in my house. A woman also is expected to have propriety of speech. Propriety in speech. She had to watch her words. She had to watch her words. She could not, for instance, talk back to her husband. And the fourth virtue, you had to have some type of skill. You had to bring something to the table. So you had to know how to sew. You had to know how to cook. You had to know how to rear. Those are the four virtues. Fidelity, physical charm, propriety in speech, and some type of skill. Now, if the girl was raised properly and there was a man who wanted to marry her, again, I'm not lying to you, a typical marriage, there was about 10 to 15 years between husband and wife. Girls were married off the moment they became women, biologically speaking, because at that point, she could fulfill the most important duty to her husband's family, making sons. But here's the funny thing. A woman's power within the household would rise not only the more sons she gave birth to, but the moment her sons got married. because the girls went to go live with the husband's household, within the husband's household. So the mom would become the matriarch over all of the daughter-in-laws. So it would be the mother-in-law's job to make sure all of the wives of her sons, you know, did their jobs responsibly. Also in Ming China, an interesting device developed aimed at keeping women in their place. Foot binding. From a young age, 5, 6, 7, a young girl's foot was broken and wrapped in such a way that as she aged, her toes essentially would curl. So you take the tip of your foot, you break it, and you wrap it around. So your toes would curl under about where your heel was. This cruel, deformative procedure was aimed at keeping women beautiful. Because under Chinese, traditional Chinese values of beauty, women with small feet were prettier. So you'd take a normal size foot and you break it to the point where it would be maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches long. And of course, to keep it deformed, you had to keep wrapping it your whole life. This was actually a woman that did it around after the rise of communist China. They actually took a picture of it. In the most rural parts of China, the custom is still practiced today. But here's the irony. Why would you do that to a girl? She can't run away. And that's the reason why if you ever see a cartoon that today is labeled as like racist or insensitive, but they show the Chinese women walking like this, that's not being racist. That's because most of them who had their foot binding couldn't walk any faster. So women were literally trapped in the house. Now, to make things more complicated, the degree of everything I just said depended upon the class that the woman herself was born into. The wealthier your status was, the more likely that your life would be completely regulated, and you had to be the epitome of beauty, and you had to obey completely, and you got your foot bound. Whereas the poorer women, now they were less restrictive, because the poorer women would end up being almost like partners with their husband. Because they had to engage in physical labor to keep the family going. So you couldn't, for instance, break the girl's foot. Just like a son. They had to go out in the field. They had to be to work to help the well-being of the family. Things like beauty, things like requirements, it was all class dependent. But there was one avenue for the poorest of the poor girls to rise to the highest levels. Concubines. The emperor's agents were constantly combing the countryside for beautiful women. If discovered, the girl would be taken from her home, brought to the capital, and would live in the Forbidden City as a concubine, part of the emperor's harem. But of course, we're only talking a few hundred to a few thousand at most. What about the social rules on fathers? Well, this picture describes it best. Dad is the most powerful figure in the household, aided by his son, who is going to be trained to be the next head of the household when Dad passes away. And serving behind her husband is the mother, always there to help the husband maintain the well-being of the household. And of course, way far in the back are the daughters, who are expected to learn what is necessary for mom to go be future wives and mothers themselves. The father is the king of the castle, literally and figuratively. Society was patriarchal, man-dominated. The eldest man in the clan was the family head, but the eldest male in the household was king of the roost. It was perfectly acceptable for a parent to impose capital punishment on their children if the children disobeyed. In other words, if you disrespected your father for any reason, your father would have absolute right to punish you. They could kick you out of the house. They could disinherit you. They could sell you into slavery. And they could kill you with no punishment, because the father was the head of the household. The last social paradox of China deals with the requirements of them to worship their ancestors. Literally, it was outlined in the legal codes. You would be lawfully required to worship your ancestors, those who came before you. But here's the catch. It was the men who worshiped the ancestors. And you only worshiped the male ancestors. So unlike the Disney cartoon Mulan, where she goes into the ancestors' room and there's all the spirits, you know, there was no women involved in actual Chinese ancestor worship. You worshiped the male figures. And only the males did the worshiping. How did they do it? Well, at annual times of celebration and recognition, all of the men in the family or the clan would gather, and they would prepare food offerings in which they would take to the cemeteries and make offerings at the site where the remains of the family members lay. Once the spiritual essence of the food was taken, then the food would be collected. It wouldn't be left to rot, but the food would then be collected and the family members would have like a party, a remembrance meal. One of the most important duties of the families were to keep lists that had the names of all of the family members. If you were a bad member of the family, your name would then be taken off the list. And guess what happened to your soul? The moment you were forgotten, it faded into nothingness. It was as if you never lived. So ancestor worship kept your ancestors' spirits alive. They heard their names, they remembered who they were in life, you charged them up with the ritual offerings. And guess what the ancestors could do for you? They could protect you. They could watch over your business. They could make sure that your wives have many healthy sons. But guess what happened if the ancestors didn't like you? Disease, sickness, failure. They believed it was associated with the ancestors. And of course, here's one of the greatest ironies. This in part is why the Chinese revere their elders. Because guess what's going to happen to Grandpa real soon? He's going to pass on. And he's going to be an ancestor. And if Grandpa does not like you, guess what Grandpa will do? He'll come back and he will haunt you. So, people always went out of their way to be extremely nice to their elders, because the last thing they wanted was payback. So why didn't the peasants push for progress? Why didn't they want reforms and change? Well, it's all this stuff combined. It's all of the social structure, the rules, the obligations. People, again, it's redundant, I've already said it, but people were born and they basically stayed in their lanes. They accepted their position in life, and they work their hardest to fulfill their obligations to family and community. Questions? Right. Well, the Ming period was also unique in many ways. And there were a couple of bizarre things that occurred that were never seen before in Chinese history. Part of the reason these revolutionary changes occurred was because during the Ming period, they had an unprecedented boom in population that was sparked by me breaking the computer. Go back, go back, go back. Had an unprecedented boom fueled by outside contacts because of the Asian trade network that we talked about, because of the Silk Road that we talked about. China, for the first time in its long history, began importing vast quantities of items that caused the population and the economy to go through the roof. Among the most important were foodstuffs that were brought to Asia from the Americas. Corn, sweet potatoes, peanuts. Those are food items that were only found in the Americas. But thanks to the Spaniards with their plantations and the Portuguese and then later the Dutch and their attempts to, you know, seize control of the Asian trade network, those items made their way to the other side of the earth and China began planting them. Because potatoes and peanuts and corn, those are really hardy plants and they can grow in almost any kind of soil. Whereas the primary foods that the Chinese produced, rice and wheat, those could only grow in specialized areas. So China began producing more food on more land. Of course, more land that was approved by Hong Wu. And guess what happens when you have more food? You're able to have more people. At the start of the Ming period, The Chinese population was about 80 million. By the end of the Ming period, in around 1600, the population doubled, estimated to be around 150 million. And then it doubled again 200 years later. They were able to do something that no other people on earth was able to do. Double their population rapidly because they produce so much food. And guess what happens when you have more people? You got more workers. And every sector of their economy exploded. Hong Wu wanted people making things. He encouraged them to make things. So like I said last class, if you're a farmer, but you had a skill, make something on the side. Make wine, make food, make tools. Make clothing, make furniture. It wasn't capitalism per se, but it was almost laissez-faire. The government got out of the way completely. Hong Wu figured something out that our politicians don't. You're going to kill your economy if you're taking half plus of the money that people make every single paycheck. But the more money they're allowed to keep in their pockets, the more they'll spend, and it will have a trickle-down effect. It happened in China to the nth degree. So many goods were being produced that the Chinese were able to begin exporting their products, which would give birth to another extraordinary development, which the Chinese refer to as the Canton system. Canton system. Canton was a southern port in China, a port city. Well, early in the Ming period, the Ming decided they were going to try to maintain what's known as a favorable balance of trade. FTB. Anyone ever hear this before? What do you think would be a favorable balance of trade for any nation?
Something that boosts their economy?
Yeah. That you're going to control trade in a way that's favorable for you. That's going to boost your economy. So what does that mean? Well, you're going to bring in those products that you don't have. But you know what you're not going to allow in? Those products that you can make. Because why do you want to have foreign competition? So to do so, the Chinese locked down their country, passed laws that essentially alluded to any foreigner being caught in China could be killed on the spot. But the only place that you could do business to come and buy Chinese products was one of two ports, the largest one being Canton. So, there literally was a harbor. And in the harbor was an island. And under the Canton system, the foreign merchants, even the Europeans, would come in with their boats. Could be full of whatever commodities were being hauled. But the merchant could only go to the island. And then there would be a Chinese merchant there that would buy the stuff that was legal and would not allow the stuff that was deemed illegal. Through this, the Chinese managed to basically dump on the world the products that they could produce in mass. Lacquerware, specially treated wood that could be used and get wet, like chopsticks. They also produce silk, you know, by the ton. Rice, you know, other items that they could produce large quantities of. That's what they would exchange. No more, no less. So they would only sell the surplus items, and they would only buy those things that they needed. They completely had a control over the process. So that way they benefited the most. Now, FYI, when the Europeans came, based on the precedent that the Portuguese set, well, similarly, the Chinese didn't want anything the Europeans had. Except for one thing. Silver. The Europeans could always bring bags of silver. And with silver, they could buy whatever Chinese products they wanted. Up to the 20th century, China received more silver than any other single society in the world economy up until the 20th century. Something like 70% of all the silver that was mined ended up in China. Because everyone wanted Chinese stuff. And this system would have an impact on Chinese society. If you were poor, you had no land, opportunity for you to work appeared. When a merchant class would appear, I guess you could call them almost like a middle class. But here's the funny thing. In Chinese culture, merchants were low on the prestige scale. They were almost as low as prostitutes. Because merchants don't make anything. All merchants do is take the product that someone makes and sells it to somebody else. But, regardless of their social status, they started making most of the silver. And what can you do with bags of silver? Bags and bags and bags of silver. You can buy yourself a nice house. You could get yourself nice clothes. You could send your kids to the Imperial Academies. Start having influence over government? Yeah, Ernest, 100% right. You could buy anything. Sky's the limit. All right. Another important development is as the population's booming, the economy's booming, people are making wealth, is that's how the Chinese would pay for military conquest. During the reign of Hong Wu, he continued to fight wars until his death in the 1390s. He managed to conquer roughly this vast area. Oops. But during the reigns of his son and his, well, I should say during the reigns of his first son, and then his fourth son was Yongul, the conquest continued. And within 60 years, the Ming Dynasty controlled more of China than almost any other dynasty that had come before it. Their control went as far south as Vietnam, as far north as, well, beyond the Korean Peninsula, into Manchuria, into modern Russia, and go back, in as far east, west rather, as the Taklamakan Desert. And of course, the mountain range of the Tibet. I mean, they just conquered. Their armies went everywhere. And these first few emperors were literally warlords. They personally led their armies. Yongul personally led 7 expeditions. His armies went multiple directions, and they conquered everything in their path. But here's another weird thing. It was Yongle who had a vision of expanding China's power beyond the confines of geography. It was Yongle who launched a Chinese age of exploration. Nearly 100 years before Columbus set sail, Yongle would dispatch his most trusted subordinate, Zheng He. Zheng He would personally lead 7 expeditions. Huge flotillas, like navies, containing hundreds of ships that would essentially sail the entirety of the Asian trade network. Their job was not only to explore, but to develop trading relations. There is physical evidence that survived, because wherever they went, they put big stone stelae in the ground, big stone monuments, essentially saying that, you know, the representative of the Son of Heaven was here. And it was written in multiple languages, and it said all the products that you could get from China by sailing to Canton. But they literally went as far as India and Persia, all the way up into the Red Sea. They went as far south as Africa. All with the same promise. Business. Let's do business. Now here's one of the most interesting recent developments. It is possible that in the 1420s and 1430s, that Zheng He circumnavigated Africa, sailed across the Atlantic Ocean, saw South America, circumnavigated South America, and came back to China. There are rumors within the records that suggest the Chinese circumnavigated the globe 100 years before Magellan. But we don't know because there's no physical evidence other than stories. But about 10 years ago, oceanic archaeologists working off the coast of Argentina discovered an old-styled anchor of the type that only the Chinese used. So if we could actually get some true factual evidence, it's possible we could rewrite history. That it wasn't Columbus who started it all, it was Zheng He. Unfortunately, one of the reasons why the records were destroyed was because Yongle's son was opposed to the waste of money that the vast fleet cost. So, 1433, in order to pay for expansion of the wall, the fleet was destroyed, all of the sailors became laborers, and essentially China stopped sending ships out abroad. Man, I hope in my lifetime they find more evidence, because that is just one of those really cool things. All right. Unfortunately for the Ming, the moment they stopped wanting to go out and explore was roughly around the same time where you started having some mediocre emperors, and the Ming kind of plateaued. The biggest problem that they made was, instead of focusing on expansion, they began to retreat inwards. And the moment they started only worrying about what was going on in China, the same familiar pattern of dynastic decline began to sit in. You had a bunch of incompetent, mediocre, bad rulers who focused on the luxuries of ruling as opposed to actually micromanaging their empire, leading armies, conquering new territories. Although I don't know if I could blame them. I mean, if you're in a palace, you have thousands of women at your fingertips that you can use however you want. You can get all the food, all of the drink. Would you really want to put on armor and go trudge out and go fight? Actually, who am I kidding? I would love that. That was me. But well, as these rulers started enjoying the luxuries of the Forbidden City, they stopped watching the government officials. They stopped monitoring the exams. They stopped demanding that merit come into play. And soon corruption set into the government. Eunuchs began to take control of life in the Forbidden City. Government agents basically isolated the emperors so they didn't know what was going on in the countryside. And hands kept going into the bags of gold and silver that were supposed to go into the royal treasuries. As the money disappeared, infrastructure began to crumble, including the critical dam and dike works along the Yellow River. They would fall into disrepair, and then when their floods happened, there would be huge catastrophes where hundreds of thousands of people would die in the destruction caused by the floods. As if proof that the Tian was angry, systematic other natural disasters began to appear. Droughts, locusts, earthquakes. Again, it's a coincidence, but in the minds of the Chinese, this is the outward proof that the end of the dynasty is upon us. And of course, when all of this bad thing is going on, it's always the poor people that suffer. There are stories that come out of the late Ming period that tell stories of peasants forced to eat bark from trees or goose poop. Children were sold into slavery. Some reported to cannibalism. People became landless because the landlords called in the mortgages. Tenants were kicked off the farms. Government agents hired criminals and started torturing people for tax payments. Crops were lost. It became bad. Criminality, cruelty, violence. All like it happened before at the end of the dynasty. But during the Ming, another unique thing occurred. Unlike any other dynasty, as the Ming begin their decline, for the first time, China is attacked by multiple foreign threats. You had people from the north coming down, assaulting the walls. That had happened before. That was nothing new. But what was new was at the same time the barbarians were at the gates, the Chinese coasts were also attacked by pirates, which the Chinese called Woku. Hundreds of Japanese and Chinese and Koreans gathered together. They bought ships. They sailed up and down the Chinese coast and attacked villages. They looted, they pillaged. All of the piracy things you think of when you hear the word pirate. I don't know if they made people walk the plank, sending them to Davy Jones' locker, but you never know. I'm sure there was a Chinese version of that. But how bad was it? Well, we don't have many stats, but it seems like the assaults were constant. But one of the worst periods was during the reign of Jiang Jin, who was the 12th of the 15 Ming emperors. He was emperor from 1522 to 1566. During that 44-year period, there were 601 recorded attacks. Every single town and village on the coast, just about, was struck. But here's the proof of how incompetent the government had become. The Chinese could never figure out how to defend the coastline from the pirates. Because the Chinese coastland was huge. You never know where they're going to appear. So how do you protect everywhere at once? You could build a wall in the north, but you can't build a wall along the ocean. So guess what they decided to do? The emperor ordered all of the coast villages to be burned. And all of the people forcibly moved inland. To take them out of the grasp of the pirates. Which, of course, completely devastated the coastal economy. But the most laughable thing is that the Chinese coast is dotted with rivers. So the farther inland that the government moved the people, the farther inland the pirates came. Now, while it didn't stop the Woku attacks, it definitely made it less profitable, but still they came. Because that's what criminals do. Questions on the Woku? Well, at the same time, Christianity appeared. Christian missionaries came with the merchants that began flowing in the Asian trade network. And they attempted to penetrate China like they tried penetrating India. There were Franciscan monks, there were Dominican monks, and they all attempted to convert the Chinese to Christianity. Now, there is no true stats suggesting whether they were super successful or not, but the numbers that I commonly stumble upon only suggest maybe tens of thousands. In a country of millions, that means they really weren't overly successful. Mostly because of Confucianism. But there were some who were aggressive. The Jesuits. That would attempt to penetrate the highest level of government. But, under Chinese laws, foreigners were never allowed to see the emperor. So the Jesuits pretty much gave up on that idea. They did try tacking some of, or I shouldn't say attacking, but converting some of the provincial leaders. There's no real evidence that any of them really converted. Because primarily the Chinese thought Christianity was silly. I mean, you're talking about a culture that worships their ancestors who lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago. They have all of these strict rules that have been in place forever, in eternity. And now you have some guys wearing dingy robes big hairy faces talking about one God who allowed his son to be killed because of bad behavior by other people. The Chinese, this concept made no sense to them. So they thought it was silly. So generally they didn't convert. But they did have curiosity for Western technology. And by the time the Jesuits appeared, it was the time of the scientific revolution. So the Jesuits brought with them clocks and cast iron cannons and calendars. Two of the most successful of these Jesuits in terms of making connections with the Chinese were Matteo Ricci and Adam Scholl. Scholl, I love the story of Scholl. Your book does have a little section, a blurb that talks about him. But Adam Scholl astounded the Chinese when he accurately predicted the coming of an eclipse. Because the Europeans had figured out how to plot eclipses going back centuries. Whereas the Chinese thought that these were cosmic, mythical events. But all they did, for the most part, was write down much of what I talked about in class. They wrote books and sent them back to Europe, and it piqued curiosity. All right, almost done for the day. How are we at with time? Oh, good. All right. Unfortunately, the end of the Ming period, the Ming Dynasty, was anything but glorious. And again, it was representative of the collapse of most of the dynasties. Essentially, it was obvious to many that the end occurred. But ultimately, they would be toppled from within. Every single dynasty that came before it followed the same pattern. Pressure, however, came from two sources. The first came from the traditional rebellions that broke out all throughout China. Peasants no longer afraid of the Chinese army. Peasants who were desperate. Banded together, attacked local landlords, attacked government officials, and basically set the countryside ablaze. But at the same time, a group of outsiders, the Manchu, also managed to penetrate China. They had gotten behind the walls. But as we're going to see next class, one of the weird things about the Manchus was they didn't fight their way in. The Ming actually invited these foreigners to come in. But faced by these two forces, the Ming didn't stand a chance. Why? Well, by 1642, by all accounts, the Ming army deserted. The soldiers were not getting paid, and they decided they didn't want to die for Chongqing, the last emperor. So if there is no army, you're not going to stop a rebellion. And it would be the rebels who initially toppled the Ming. One rebel leader, a man by the name of Li Qiang, his band operating in northern China, managed to march on Beijing, the capital, gain entry into the city, and going so far as to penetrate the Forbidden City. the palace of the emperor. Ironically, the last Ming emperor, Chongqing, he was so out of touch with what was going on in China, he didn't realize he didn't have an army anymore. No one told him. He didn't realize that there was no one actually guarding the gates. He didn't realize there was a rebellion. He was raised in the confines, the bubble of the Forbidden City. Apparently, he didn't become aware of the rebellion until Li Qiang's rebels were going over the wall of the Forbidden City. The emperor didn't realize there was a rebellion until he physically saw the rebels. And what he did is emblematic of how weak of a ruler he was. Rather than face capture, he ordered his three sons to change into the clothes of peasants and sneak out in the chaos and go hide with relatives away from the city. His concubines, well, he found all of his favorite ones and he killed them with his own sword, because he wasn't going to let his concubines, you know, be sexualized by these rebels. He actually tried killing his daughter. He managed to kill one and cut the arm off of another. Then, after he took care of all of his girls, he dresses like a eunuch, orders the empress to commit suicide, which she did. She hung herself. And then he tried fleeing. He went down one corridor, saw rebels. Turned around, went down another corridor, saw rebels. Went down another corridor, saw rebels. When he realized there was no escape, he went into a park in the middle of his palace, went underneath his favorite tree, and he hung himself. But according to legend, he left a note in his robes. And the note allegedly said, "I die unable to face my ancestors in the underworld. Dejected and ashamed, may the rebels dismember my corpse, slaughter my officials, but let them not despoil the imperial tombs, nor harm a single one of my people." He realized the end was there. Now here's the irony. This is where we're going to finish. When Li Qiang found Zhong Zhen's corpse, Li Qiang claimed he had the mandate of heaven. He proclaimed the creation of a new dynasty, which he called the Shun Dynasty. But the Shun Dynasty was one of the shortest dynasties in the history of China. It would only last a little over a year, because he was never able to establish control over China. That would be done by the Manchu. Mm-hmm. And we'll deal with them on Tuesday. All right. Like I said to the people here who were early, I didn't get a chance to finish all your exams. I should have them done by Tuesday. I only received extra credit from one person. So if you didn't think you did well on the first exam, now is the time to start the extra credit for the second exam. So open up the PDF file, that's the book. Go beyond the first couple of chapters. Find the Chinese and Asian chapter. Answer those chapter review questions, define those terms, and then go down to the gunpowder empires of the Islamic empires and do the same thing. Get ahead of the game. Start earning extra credit. Yes?
Can you send them extra credit as soon as we do it? Or do
yes. Whatever you want to do. The only thing you can't do is you can't go back.
Yeah, that's fine.
So you can't do the exam chapters for the first exam. But you can work on the questions for the second exam.
You want them via email?
You're going to send them to me via email, yep. You can do it as an attached document. You could do it as a Google Doc. Or you can cut and paste it and send it.
Appreciate it.
Have a nice weekend, everyone.
Thank you, too.
Take care. We'll see you. I did. You're the one I was talking about. Yeah, I got you. I got you.
Yeah, but I say.
You too. Bye. Hasta la vista. Ernest was here. Cam was here. I don't think Tyler was here. And I don't think Sarah was there. Josh was here, though. Brandon came in. David was here. Okay, good.